Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $200 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, spread, totals, player props.
$200 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In app only.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Once upon a mundane morning, Barb's day got busy without warning. A realtor in need of an open house sign? No, 50 of them and designed before 9.
My head hurts.
Any mighty tools to help with this plight?
Aha!
Barb made her move. She opened Canva and got in the groove.
Bulk creating Canva sheets. Create 50 signs fit for suburban streets.
Done in a click, all complete.
Sweet!
Now, imagine what your dreams can become when you put imagination to work at Canva.com.
We're joined in this portion of our program by Dr. Carlos Hill. Dr. Hill is an associate professor of history at Texas Tech University. He is talking with us on our program about an interesting book entitled Beyond the Rope, The Impact of Lynching on Black Culture and Memory. Dr. Hill is joining us by phone on our program from his home in the state of Texas. First of all, it's nice to have you join us on our program. Good morning.
Thank you for having me.
A lot of different thoughts come to mind in beginning this discussion, but I'll ask a question I normally ask authors. Your motivation for this book, what was that?
You know, I wanted to write a book that really helped us to think differently about the history of lynching. Too often, I think, even amongst historians, but definitely amongst the public, we have one way of understanding lynching, and that is of African Americans being victims of lynching and whites being the perpetrators of lynching. And so in my study of lynching, I found that that wasn't always true, that in some cases, and there's a handful of cases of African Americans lynching other African Americans, there are instances where African Americans didn't necessarily think of themselves as victims, but as heroic figures, lynch victims as victims, but as heroic figures. And so I wanted to write this book in order to really complicate our understanding of the Black experience of lynching.
When we talk about having even a conversation on this topic, for a lot of people, it's a very painful conversation. How do you respond to that?
Lynching is a very painful subject in African American history. And in many ways, people see the history of lynching or the era of lynching as the real low point in African American history after the Civil War. And so it's definitely painful. And for me, as a young scholar, beginning to learn about the history in detail, there were many days that I was depressed. There was many days that I was angry. But part of, you know, my maturation in the process was to really understand that the history of lynching wasn't just Black victimization. There were many instances where African Americans fought back. There were many instances where African Americans mobilized and organized political movements in response to lynching. And so the history of lynching, while it's an ugly history, while it's a traumatic history, it's also a history of empowering stories. It's also a history of resilience. It's also a history of courage. And so and this is in part why I wanted to write the book, because the history is much more complicated than we typically think about.
A lot of people are repulsed by even the thought of lynching, but back in the mid to late 1800s, it was something that was, relatively speaking, accepted in a lot of communities. Can you tell us about that?
Yes. I mean, the history of lynching stretches back to the colonial era. And actually, the term lynching comes from Colonel Charles Lynch, who was a colonel in the American Revolutionary Army. And he was famous for punishing suspected British loyalists by tarring and feathering them. You know, so he tarred and feathered them without giving them a trial. And so the term lynching, in many ways, comes from Colonel Charles Lynch from the American Revolutionary era. And so lynching stretches back all the way into to the founding of America. And so in the 18th century, the 19th century, lynching was a form of popular justice, particularly in rural areas, in expanding areas in America. And so it has a long history. And to be quite honest, whites were the primary victims of lynching during the 18th century as well as 19th century. But things change after the Civil War, particularly in around the 1880s, 1890s period, when African Americans become the primary targets of lynching. And this is where my book, Beyond the Rope, really picks up. It's trying to tell a story of how lynching goes from being a form of popular justice that's primarily targets whites, to a form of racial social control that primarily targets African Americans. And so after about 1886, African Americans are the primary targets of lynching, and lynching becomes synonymous with African Americans. And so we think of, white lynch mobs and black victims as the totality of the history of lynching. It's actually just one chapter of lynching in America.
The Chicago Tribune in 1882 actually started keeping lynching statistics. Did that surprise you when you found that out?
In some ways, it was surprising, in part because even in the 1880s, and even though lynching had a long history, there was really no real reason for the Chicago Tribune in 1882 to begin to collect data, because this is well before the modern anti-lynching movement emerges. This is before there are loud outcries against lynching. And so it's a little bit curious as to why in 1882 the Chicago Tribune begins to try to tabulate the number of lynchings. But nonetheless, it's, because they did that, it's provided us some fairly concrete figures on the number of lynch victims in America in that year and going forward. And so thanks to the Chicago Tribune, as well as later the NAACP and a few other anti-lynching groups, we have a fairly robust idea of the number of lynchings that occurred in America beginning in the late 19th century.
Some people would be surprised by occasions where blacks were lynched by other blacks.
Yes.
How often did that occur?
Well, not often. In the history of lynching, we only know that about 148 cases of black vigilantism occurred. A group of African Americans lynching another African American. Although it sounds shocking to us today, because again, we typically perceive a lynching to be about a group of whites lynching a black person. When we think about the late 19th century, before lynching has become racialized, before black people are synonymous with lynch victims, lynching is a form of social control. And in some communities, and particularly black communities, rural black communities in the South, it's a form of crime control. One of the things that becomes really clear when you study black vigilantism closely is that there's this belief that white authorities who are in control refuse to punish crimes perpetuated that black people perpetuate against other black people. They tend not to, you know, investigate. They tend not to get charged. They tend not to be punished in general. And so in regard to some crimes like rape and murder, you had groups of African Americans who felt that the criminal justice system wasn't working, wasn't going to work, take the law into their own hands, and lynch alleged or suspected deviants who, again, they committed. Typically, when a black lynch mob lynched another black person, it was for the crime of rape or murder. Those were the two primary allegations that precipitated black vigilantism. And so really serious, violent crimes. Whereas in comparison, when we talk about white black lynching, there are at least 100 reasons that have been given, that were given for lynching a black person. Some serious, some silly, from the perspective of, you know, the 21st century. And so while, you know, black vigilantism is lynching, and I don't try to, you know, walk away from that, it is lynching. It is, you know, these were extra legal, you know, executions, and, you know, but they were different in the terms of what motivated them and why they occurred.
What was the response of the black press at that time?
In many ways, they were the black press in the 1880s, as far as I've been able to ascertain, was silent about black vigilantism in the 1880s and in the early 1890s. But again, this is before lynching has become a form of racial social control, and the narratives that are used to explain and justify lynching are racialized. Once it becomes racialized, then you see the black press, you know, condemning lynching in all forms, whether it's black vigilantism or white on black vigilantism. And so it took, you know, apologists of lynching to really try to, you know, when as they racialized lynching, to take the black press to really take a hard and fast stance on it.
It is Sunday morning on The Fan. Good morning, everybody. This is Bob Salter. We're in discussion on our program with a number of guests over the course of our show. We're on till 7:30 when the NFL preview program happens on The Fan. This is a big football Sunday on WFAN. We're in discussion with Dr. Carlos Hill. This portion of our program is the author of Beyond the Rope, The Impact of Lynching on Black Culture and Memory. More with you, Dr. Hill, as we continue this Sunday morning. We're talking on our program with Dr. Carlos Hill. Dr. Hill is an associate professor of history at Texas Tech University. He's talking with us about his book, Beyond the Rope, The Impact of Lynching on Black Culture and Memory. I'm Bob Salter. You know, I mentioned in introducing you that you're an associate professor of history at Texas Tech. What do your students say about this topic?
You know, my students have the kind of reactions that I had when I first started studying lynching. They're appalled by that a person, an American citizen, could be lynched, could be executed, and in broad daylight, and nothing happened to the individuals who committed this crime. They're appalled by that. They're appalled by the brutality of lynch mobs. They're appalled by the coarse and callousness of individuals in terms of justifying lynchings. And so part of what I try to do as a scholar on lynching and someone who teaches about this is to try to get them to move beyond that sort of jerk reaction of being appalled and try to really understand why these individuals saw lynching as something that was normal, that was acceptable, that was morally justifiable, how they saw it as a part of the fabric of society, just the way things were. I try to get them to understand that, because if they don't, if they just walk away being appalled, they really haven't learned about the history of lynching. And so they tend to have the same reaction, but over the course of the semester, they began to understand that lynching was a part of a broader social system. It was part of Jim Crow segregation. It was a part of disenfranchisement. And so it was a part of a three-legged stool early 20th century America that made the society work. And so once they get that perspective, although they remain appalled, they have a deeper understanding of how this could happen, and no one, particularly white Americans, do something to prevent it. And so it's a process. But typically, over the course of the semester, students come out on the other side.
It's interesting when you look at the way in which, you know, the black newspapers would characterize those who were lynched as empowered and heroic versus the way that an organization like the NAACP, National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, will frame those same people as dehumanized victims.
Yeah.
Why do you think there's that different treatment of basically the same stories?
You know, what I say in the book is that, you know, the lynched black body as a symbol was a floating signifier. What I mean by that in just plain English is that over time, black people have thought differently, had different attitudes and different agendas for the lynched black body as a symbol. And so for the NAACP, who, you know, lobbied Congress from, you know, 1920 all the way through 1950 for an anti-lynching law, or for a federal anti-lynching law, it was important for them to present African-American lynch victims as victims, even perfect victims, who needed the federal government to intervene on their behalf. And so it was incumbent upon the NAACP to present lynch victims as being brutalized, as their civil rights being trampled upon, and the only entity in this country that could actually intervene to prevent lynchings from occurring and to protect African Americans, helpless African Americans, helpless victims, was the federal government. And so because of that, the NAACP needed to present black people in this way. Whereas when you move outside of the political realm and you have African American activists as well as African American writers trying to understand black lynch victims as something more than perfect victims, something more than helpless victims, and there's also this need to try to cope with the trauma of lynching, one of the strategies became to conceive of black lynch victims as not simply victims, because they were victims. And those writers who portray them as heroic figures acknowledge that. But they're not only victims, and that's the key. Because if they were only victims, there was no empowering story that one can tell. There was no redeeming story that one can tell. And so for some black writers, I argue in the book that Ida B. Wells, who's sort of who was a modern anti-lynching crusader, she begins this genre of what I call consoling narratives, which is this genre of portraying African-American lynch victims as heroic figures. And the way in which they were portrayed as heroic figures is because they fought back against their, against white lynchers. In some cases, they killed white lynchers. And so I emphasize African-American, writers who portray black lynch victims as courageously standing up to the mob, killing some members of the mob, but nonetheless fighting back. And in doing so, they claim their citizenship. Even in some cases, they're able to claim their manhood that was being deprived by lynch, or was attempted to be deprived by lynch mobs. And so in all these ways, black writers try to tell from the same story, right, a different story, a story of empowerment and heroism in order to create what I call a usable past, or a past that could become a basis for empowerment. And so this is how and why black people, particularly in these two circumstances, have seen very different things in the lynched black body.
The Behind the Veil Oral History Project was a resource that you used when writing your book. Could you tell us a little bit about it?
Yes, the Behind the Veil Oral History Project that was based, or is based, at Duke University began in the mid-1990s and sort of came to an end in the late 1990s. But what the Behind the Veil Project did is it went around the South. There were interviewers from Duke University, mostly graduate students, that went around the South interviewing African Americans, typically in their 60s, 70s, and 80s, about their lives during the Jim Crow period. And so this is, you know, they in doing that, they amassed several thousand interviews with African Americans who had lived during the era, even some whites who lived during the era. And basically, that archive of interviews gave me a basis for trying to understand the impact that lynching had on black communities during this era. But more importantly, how those individuals remembered the history of lynching, how they narrated stories about lynching. And so I was really interested in to see how, you know, various groups of African Americans, so wealthier African Americans or upper middle class African Americans, working class African Americans, African Americans who had been children versus adults during this period, you know, how did they remember lynching? And so in many ways, the kinds of narratives that they told were eerily similar to the kinds of narratives that people were telling during the 1920s and 1930s about the history about lynching. And so the range of stories that were told were very similar to the stories that were told earlier. And so without that archive of sources, I wouldn't have been able to really talk about how ordinary African Americans conceived of, thought about the history of lynching.
Final thought for you. You're very kind with your time, too. The Black Lives Matter movement obviously has gotten an awful lot of attention and focus in this country, and as a result, has basically spawned what some would refer to as kind of a counter-narrative campaign. What's parallel, if there can be drawn to the kind of campaign that was engaged in against lynching?
Hey, I mean, today, you know, Black Lives Matter is pushing against the narrative that these shootings of unarmed African Americans are justifiable killings or justifiable shootings. They're really pushing against that narrative, and they're seeking to replace that narrative with the narrative of these are instances of police brutality. These are instances of excessive force. And so absolutely the Black Lives Matter movement, the heart of that movement is about telling a counter narrative of these police shootings of unarmed African Americans. The parallel is during the early 20th century, you had apologists, particularly white apologists of lynching, saying that the reason why these lynchings are necessary is to subdue black savagery. And I know that language sounds really, harsh, but in the early 20th century, African American men were portrayed as black beast rapists who were raping white women. And in order to subdue or to contain, you know, black sexual deviance, right, lynching was necessary. And so you had people like Ida B. Wells, who I mentioned earlier, as a anti-lynching crusader, who sort of comes along and argues that African American men aren't raping white women. They are, in many ways, the reason why they are lynched is because they're agitating for their social and political rights. And so she sought to displace that narrative of black beast rapists with the narrative of white lynchers are lynching blacks because they are agitating for social, political, and economic equality. And so there are definite parallels between the Black Lives Matter movement of the 21st century and the anti-lynching movement, whether it's the NAACP or Ida B. Wells of the early 20th century. And so in many ways, what the history of lynching teaches us is that narratives matter, right? How the ordinary person conceives of, thinks of social phenomena matters. And so the way in which you get people to change their attitudes is not necessarily to convince them to convince them that they're right or they're wrong, but to get them to understand a new narrative. And if you can get them to understand a new narrative, become more sensitive to a narrative, maybe you can ultimately change attitudes about a particular phenomenon. And so I think that's the lesson that I think, if Black Lives Matter, if the Black Lives Matter movement or elements of the movement are interested in this, the history of lynching, that's one important lesson to take from it.
The voice of Dr. Carlos Hill, our guest in this portion of our program. He's an associate professor of history at Texas Tech University, author of Beyond the Rope, The Impact of Lynching on Black Culture and Memory. Thank you very much for being kind with your time. Certainly good luck with this book and with your work. Certainly it's a wonderful discussion as well.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me, Bob.
It's another huge fall sports Sunday here on The Fan. It is Sunday morning on The Fan. As a matter of fact, it's a football Sunday. NFL preview happens at 7:30. I'm Bob Salter. We're in discussion with Dr. Susan Ball on our program. She is Associate Professor of Medicine at Weill Cornell Medical College, Assistant Director of the Birnbaum Unit, the Center for Special Services, New York Presbyterian Hospital, and author of Voices in the Band, and is talking with us on our program here on The Fan this morning. One of the things that I was thinking is, when the early patients with AIDS and HIV faced stigma, how did they deal with that?
Oh, you know, stigma is such a hard thing for everybody, for any individual. And so, stigma from HIV early on came from fear and from lack of knowledge. I think of that, the really prominent case of a person dealing with stigma was the young boy Ryan White, who you may have heard of and is sort of indirectly responsible for a lot of the funding that really does support patients with HIV in this country now due to an act of Congress in the late 80s, I think. He was a young boy who was infected with HIV from because he's a hemophiliac, and his diagnosis was made, I think, in 1987, and he lived in Indiana, and they wouldn't let him go to school because they were afraid he had HIV, and he was stigmatized as someone who was, this pariah, someone who was going to infect the whole school, or someone who could, was a dangerous person to be around. And, we knew very early on that this was an infection that really had to be, you had to have sex with someone, it was really a blood-to-blood infection. So Brian White was not going to give HIV to his schoolmates, sitting in the classroom or eating lunch in the cafeteria with them. But people really were frightened. And so when there's fear like that, that can really lead to bad behavior among adults. And so he was a pretty overt example of what stigma can do and what it does. For my patients individually, oftentimes stigma isolates them and does not and prevents them or acts as a barrier to getting care, because stigma's still around. I have some patients, I have a couple of new patients actually who are elderly, not so elderly, but they're women in their 60s, and for them the HIV diagnosis is new, and they're in the African American community, and they are very isolated in their diagnosis because they just feel that they cannot tell anyone, not even anyone in their families, and so that leads to problems because they don't want to come to their appointments because people will ask questions, or they don't want to have pills because people will say, well, what are those for? So that stigma can really, really interfere with good care, among, you know, other more kind of sinister things that stigma can do.
Well, when we speak of stigma, we also have to speak of the silence that there was surrounding even the mention of AIDS on the part of the president at that time, Ronald Reagan.
Yeah.
It was 1986 before he actually mentioned AIDS in a speech.
Yeah.
Which, even to this day, seems just unbelievable.
Right? It seems unbelievable. I mean, you know, literally thousands of Americans were dying from HIV. And when you think of the, I always think of, you know, the bird flu epidemic or SARS, or look at Ebola, you know, three Americans, and people were going crazy. And, you know, the government response was, you know, under fire and under great scrutiny. And yet, with, you're absolutely right, with the HIV epidemic in the 80s and really no mention of it from the head of the government, it was really quite something. And one has to wonder, you know, would this epidemic have taken the course it did had there been even a little more political will to do something about it earlier on? Yeah, you have to, I think, you know, when you study this epidemic and the history of it, you can't help but ask that question.
When we look at Ronald Reagan's finally mentioning the word AIDS in a speech, what did that do to, I guess, public awareness, and I hate to use this phrase, but I'm going to, almost public acceptance of the fact that AIDS was a reality?
It's, you know, I think certainly his mention of it garnered great attention in 1986. It was really, you know, a documentable event that, oh, here the president mentioned it. I would say that, you know, the death of Rock Hudson, I think a year prior, that really put it on people's radars. Like, here is, you know, an actor who was America's sweetheart. I was in college at the time, but, or maybe in medical school, but he, when Rock Hudson died, and a lot of prominent actors, like Elizabeth Taylor, you know, went to his funeral and talked about it, and it became something that was much, much more public. And that, I think, really gave the wider public in the United States this understanding that this was an infection that really a lot of people could get, virtually anybody could get, and that it wasn't, you know, reserved for the gay man who was in New York City, you know, buried away and you would never talk to. You know, it could be something that was, you know, in your next door neighbor. So that I think was a real catalyst. But certainly Ronald Reagan finally mentioning it in a speech did bring it to a public eye and a public acknowledgement that this was something that really had been ignoring for too long.
What about patient reluctance to go on AZT? Was that something that was justified?
Yes and no. I mean, you know, again, AZT was approved in 1987 as the first and only, at the time, medication to treat the HIV. So in the face of having had nothing approved, some people were just desperate. I'll take, you know, whatever you want to give me, I'll take. This is really important. Others felt that the drug had not been adequately tested, that had not been in tests for long enough, that it was, you know, and there was always this kind of subgroup of people that felt that HIV was a plot all along. There were those who fell into that camp. Oh, this is just another method, you know, that the government's tricking us, or the, you know, the drug companies are trying to make more money. But, you know, in fact, it was initially, based on the studies that were done, it did seem to help people's immune systems. We knew from later studies, as the drug was out for more years, that ultimately alone as a single agent, it was not effective in reducing mortality rates. But we didn't know that again till 3 or 4 years later. But also because patients were so sick, often when they did take the drug, and then it wouldn't really necessarily turn things around for them. It might very transiently make their immune systems a little better. So a lot of people died when they took it, and so that of course led to, you know, the word on the street being this is a drug that'll kill you. And then then it had side effects also initially in the first doses that were made. It really did have a fair amount of side effects, not for everybody but for some people. So it had a lot of problems with it. But as I say, it's still around. It is still a drug that some people are taking in their regimens, and does accomplish the inhibition of the replication that it's supposed to, but it can't work alone. Single drugs are not effective for HIV. You need a combination of medications.
And for patients sticking with the idea of basically a cocktail regime, how tough was that for some of them?
Well, early on, when we did when the protease inhibitors were approved, and we did have really what we knew was an effective regimen, it involved a lot of pills for people, and the minimum doses was several pills three times a day, usually on an empty stomach. And then there were a couple other regimens. Several protease inhibitors were approved quite rapidly, but none of them were easy to take, and all had multiple doses, multiple times a day. And so that really required a real commitment on the patient side. So for some patients, that was fine. They really, that's what they needed to do, that's what they were going to do, and that's what they did. And so, you know, we had patients who never ever missed their medication and did beautifully, did really well. And for others, it was really a trial, really a difficult thing, you know, for people. As I said, for our patients, some of whom were really from the margins of society, you know, they might not have a steady place to live, they might not have a refrigerator, they might not brush their teeth every morning. So taking medication day after day after day, three times a day or even twice a day, was something that was very, very difficult for them. And other patients just might have had the circumstances to take medicine every day. They may have been stably housed, but they just, taking medicine reminded them of having this illness, and that was very hard. They felt like there were too many side effects that they just didn't want to deal with. So there's a whole spectrum of reasons or even justifications of why patients wouldn't take their medicine as consistently as we would recommend that they should. Fortunately, it's gotten a lot easier, and the medicines over time have become more and more tolerable. Fewer doses are needed, and a number of the medications have been combined into one pill. You know, the standard regimen to take for HIV now is one pill once a day. So we've come enormously far in being able to treat it effectively in a way that's really doable for patients.
You don't refer to patients who don't take their medication as being non-compliant. A lot of doctors use that terminology. Why not on your part?
We did for a long time, but I think there just became so apparent that this was really a major issue, this issue of compliance or adherence. So we really needed to be able to have patients take their medicine consistently, but we didn't want to be pejorative in what we were saying to them. So I don't know exactly when the shift occurred, but it was, I would say, probably more than 10 years ago. The idea that patients were being non-compliant implied they were, you know, not doing what we said. And, you know, that it really, you know, this is treatment we're offering to people or we're recommending for people, but people are adults. People make decisions about their lives and what they want to do every day. And so it seemed that adherence was a more supportive and more direct way of saying, you know, this is a regimen we've, you know, you're supposed to take your medicine once a day, every day, and if you don't do that, you're not adherent to the regimen. But the issue of compliance, we felt, had too much of a sort of a, you know, do as I say concept to it, and that didn't seem right.
More with you, Dr. Susan Ball, as we continue on our program this Sunday morning. It's Football Sunday, and of course, Sports Edge follows 8 o'clock update, NFL preview at 7:30, and we take a pause for our top of the hour update here on The Fan. We are in discussion with Dr. Susan Ball on our program. We began this chat in our 6 o'clock hour, and we're in the home stretch of our discussion with you, Dr. Ball. Dr. Ball, for those of you just joining us, is Associate Professor of Medicine at Weill Cornell Medical Center, Assistant Director of the Birnbaum Unit Center for Special Services at New York Presbyterian Hospital, and author of Voices in the Band, and she has joined us on a program. It's interesting chat that we are having, and one of the things I've been thinking about is with the conversations that you have with patients and thinking of the perspective over the more than 20 years that you've been talking with patients, obviously the conversations, I'm assuming, have changed. Has that eased your job at all?
It's my, as I said a little bit earlier, my job's quite different now than it was in the earliest days when I started. I do a lot more sort of what we would call primary care. But so I'm asking patients about, are they taking their medicine? Are there any problems taking their medicine? But I also ask, you know, a lot of questions about, are they taking their other medicine? Because at this point, patients are living longer. They may have other illnesses to deal with, things like diabetes or high blood pressure, you know, that also need chronic treatment. So I ask a lot about those illnesses and those treatments and do a lot of lifestyle counseling for patients, you know, to get more exercise, to eat better. Certainly to quit smoking. We have a high percentage of our patients are smokers, and that's, I feel like I spend a lot of time trying to get people to quit smoking. So I'm spending much more time in the office setting as opposed to in the hospital, rounding on patients. So that's very different than it was. I would say also that, patients, they are aware that there's medicine for them, and that there's less of an urgency from patients. I think in the early 90s there was, you know, people were so sick, but people were also worried and frightened, and so there was a sort of a sense of urgency in those bad old days. That's not so much there now. And I, you know, patients feel like, well, if I don't take my medicine correctly, I can take a different regimen, and I don't feel so worried. I've one woman who she's just been very difficult to get to take her medications for her HIV, and her HIV is not well controlled, and I worry about it a lot. And when I see her in the office, she looks fine. She feels great. She doesn't feel a sense of worry, even though her immune system is quite suppressed. And I feel like she's on thin ice, if you want to use that expression. But she feels fine, so she doesn't feel so worried. And so it's quite a difference from where we were 20 years ago.
Mm. Every spring, we have the AIDS walks in cities around the country.
Yeah.
Obviously, big one in New York. What do those walks do?
Well, in New York, the AIDS walk specifically raises money for the Gay Men's Health Crisis, which is a very large organization that serves people with HIV throughout the city and provides all kinds of services that include things like access to legal care, provides many, many kinds of groups for patients looking for support groups or socializing groups or medication adherence groups. It also provides a lot of different kinds of counseling and helps direct people into care. You know, if people go there without and don't have a doctor or want to get a different doctor because they're moving or something, the Gay Men's Health Crisis can help them, you know, get into care. And I think throughout the country, that's mostly what those walks do is raise money for different HIV facilities, because I think in some cities it actually helps raise money for actual medical facilities, depending on where they are. But they also, you know, get people out in the city, and it allows some people who have links to HIV or maybe HIV positive themselves or maybe a family members, you know, people, they're very, very fun social events where people, is in New York anyway, you know, thousands of people walk. And so sometimes, you know, whole neighborhoods will come out just to, you know, raise awareness and recognition that HIV hasn't gone away. It's still very much around, but that, you know, walking is raising awareness as well as raising money for it.
Dr. Susan Ball, who is Associate Professor of Medicine at Weill Cornell Medical College and Assistant Director of the Birnbaum Unit Center for Special Studies at New York Presbyterian Hospital, author of Voices in the Band, A Doctor, Her Patients, and How the Outlook on AIDS Care Changed from Doomed to Hopeful. Thank you very much for joining us and sharing some of your perspective on your work.
Thanks.
With us.
Thank you so much, Bob. It's been a pleasure to speak to you this morning.
And certainly congratulations on your work, too.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
This is Bob Salter, joined by Dr. Frieda Pauly. She is joining us on our program to talk with us. We're going to find out about Pymetrics. This is an interesting venture. First of all, it's nice to have you join us on our program. Good morning.
Thank you, Bob. Nice to be here.
How do you describe what Pymetrics is?
Sure. Pymetrics is a way of using neuroscience to help people understand what their best career fit is and then help them link up with their best job options.
How did you come up with this idea?
I spent a lot of time in the neuroscience world. I used to be an academic neuroscientist. And then I went to business school and realized that when I was going through the program, myself and my colleagues didn't really have anything that tapped into what we had know about neuroscience in the brain to help us understand what our best career fit options were. And so I was frustrated by that because it's a really powerful way of understanding what your cognitive and emotional strengths are and then understanding how those fit in the career world. And so I set about to build it.
And how long did that process take?
It took a couple years that we had to do. My co-founder and I are both neuroscientists. We had to do a lot of research into what cognitive and emotional traits were predictive of job outcomes. And then we had to build the technology, and then we had to do a lot of proof of concept work to really link, you know, the traits to different careers. But, you know, now we have a pretty robust system that, you know, will put you through 20 minutes worth of computer games that look at your cognitive and emotional traits and then tell you, hey, here are your best career fits. And then, you know, companies are now using this to find people that are well suited for them. So it's a couple of years, but it's been worth it.
Coming up with those traits that you mentioned that are very key at the part of this, how did you do that?
Yeah, sure. So we interviewed a lot of people in the human capital space to understand, you know, what are the things that are important for you to know about somebody? You know, they would tell us things like, oh, we want to know if someone can learn well or how flexible they are or, you know, how emotionally sensitive they are. And so what we did as neuroscientists is, neuroscience has a lot of these computer exercises. We call them games, but, you know, they're exercises that you do on the computer that have been developed to look at all these different traits. And so we just went out and found these games, pulled them all together, and then put them on our online platform. But it was really through a lot of interviewing of people in the field to understand what they thought were important for different professional jobs.
And when you talk about this idea of, you know, using gaming, essentially, to do this, how is that received?
Well, we always have to explain to people that it's not Nintendo or Wii or Angry Birds or, you know, gaming just means that it's not a questionnaire. It means that it's an activity that you do on the computer that is actually more fun. Most people find it more fun than filling out a long survey. But it's, you know, we have to explain that all of these games are, I'm using air quotes, you can't see me now, but I always use air quotes, are really scientific exercises that have been developed over the last 20 years and are very well validated in the science community. We've just made them a little bit more fun, but underlying it all is a very, very strong proven scientific methodology.
By the way,
so once you explain it that way, people like it. And then honestly, people are looking for a better way to engage with job seekers. You know, I think a lot of people want, both on the job seeking side and on the company side, people would really think that there are better ways to work the process rather than the current system. So I think everyone's looking for a way to make something more entertaining while at the same time being actually more scientifically valid than some of the things that are, you know, going on now. I mean, resume review is not very scientifically valid, for example.
By the way, I always use air quotes, so
yeah.
you fit right in here.
On a radio show.
Yeah, definitely.
Right?
Yes. I love it when I make a neuroscientist smile on a Sunday morning. Dr. Frieda Pauly is talking with us on our program on The Fan. More with you, Dr. Pauly, as we talk about pie metrics, and we get into talking a little bit more about this. It's a fascinating area of discussion. I hope our listeners are finding it as fascinating as I am. After our 8 o'clock updates, speaking of fascinating things, it is the Sports Edge program. Rick Wolf will be along with that fine show. Really get us in gear on a football Sunday. It's the NFL preview program that happens at 7:30 this Sunday morning. It is Sunday morning on The Fan. Good morning, everybody. Football Sunday, as a matter of fact. After our 8 o'clock update, Rick Wolf has the Sports Edge and the NFL preview program along at 7:30 this morning. We're in discussion with Dr. Frieda Pauly on our program. Dr. Pauly is a neuroscientist, founder of Pymetrics, P-Y-M-E-T-R-I-C-S. And she's talking with us about Pymetrics on our program. You know, Dr. Pauly, one of the things I was thinking in the first portion of our chat in this half hour of our program, this approach must be interesting from the standpoint of companies, because companies are really looking for the best possible candidate. And in a way, what you're talking about for employers, it would seem, could be perhaps more efficient than that quick scan of somebody's resume?
That's exactly right. And that's where we insert Pymetrics. It's not to replace the interview or any sort of human-to-human interaction. It's really to make that initial decision as to whether you want to bring someone in. And, you know, there's been so much research recently, Bob, on, you know, resume review and how it's biased against diversity candidates and how it, you know, really that there are so many, and not only that, but just, you know, how really GPA and test scores and things like that are not indicative of future performance. And so what we do is we built a system that, you know, takes about the same time as it would for somebody to upload a resume and, you know, go through all the, you know, hassle of doing that, but that actually yields outcomes that are way better, and also do not, basically people right now using resume review might be missing out on talent just because of unconscious bias that's leading them to think, oh, you know, this person can't be a good fill in the blank because, you know, my unconscious belief system kind of biases me against that. And that's especially true in sort of STEM hiring when it comes to diversity candidates. But it's really, you know, there's just so much research showing that that's true in so many different ways, that humans just unfortunately have these unconscious biases that are, you know, a little bit tricky to get around. And so this is a system that can really help with that.
The idea
and really allow you to get the best candidates anywhere, no matter where they come from or, you know, anything like that.
The idea of workplace diversity has, you know, been a buzzword a lot lately. How can this work address some of those concerns?
Sure. So the way that it can address it is that it is really like The Voice, okay, or blind auditions for orchestras. So, you know, prior to having blind auditions for orchestras, women comprised 5% of the musicians. After blind auditions, the number was closer to 35%. And really, you know, plyometrics is exactly the same way. We know nothing about a person when they go through our games. We don't collect any demographic information. All we know is sort of how they do on these exercises. And so it really can eliminate any bias that might exist in terms of, again, diversity, you know, sort of educational background, anything that might currently be affecting the process. Just like, you know, on The Voice, you don't know anything about the person. You just can hear their music and have and their voice and how they sound. And so it just really allows people to focus on that rather than whatever other extraneous factors that aren't really relevant might be influencing your decision. So that's, it's basically the same thing.
Two thoughts, and by the way, we're talking with Dr. Frieda Poli on our program. I'm Bob Salter. One is, you know, it sounds like such a great idea. Why did nobody think of this before, or had they? And then the other aspect of this is, where do you see this ultimately going? In other words, what's the dream with this?
Sure, absolutely. So, you know, people had not thought of it before just because, you know, neuroscience is a very new field. It's really only been around for 15, 20 years now. And it takes a while for people to kind of crystallize that knowledge and then have that knowledge be something that can be translated into something other than a scientific research project, right? So it just takes a while for this knowledge to really get out of academia and into the real world. So that's simply why it hasn't been done before. And, you know, now there's a couple companies that are looking to do this, so we're not the only one. So I think it's time. And then the dream is really that, you know, that something like this become a important part of the career process, right? I mean, it's, you know, right, our dream would be that a significant number of people at least utilize something like this to really understand their career fit, because it works in three ways. You can use it to find your career fit as a person that's just in the world looking to see what I can do best. You can use it for recruiting as a company, and then you can also use it for internal mobility within a company, right? Internal mobility is really just career assessment, but done within a company. And so our dream is really that this become a you know, significant way that people can find their optimal career, and that companies can really find, you know, the best people. Because again, all we're trying to do is replace that initial resume review screening process, which everybody, I've yet to find someone that thinks that's a great way of doing things. And so something like this system, something related to this, is just a much better approach.
And in a way, could this be applied to, you know, things like summer interns when they're looking to latch on,
yes,
and get a position, you know?
Absolutely, yeah. And we've done some work with companies using it for summer interns. So it's really not, I mean, you know, this tool is almost, you know, best suited for somebody that has never worked and has no, you know, work experience. Or, you know, we really think this tool is really for sort of the 35 and under crowd, where, you know, your exposure to different jobs is limited. I mean, I think, you know, by the time you're, I don't know, later on in life, you have more experience with different opportunities, and, you know, hopefully you've kind of understood where you're best suited in the world, although not necessarily. But the point is that I think for somebody who has no experience in the job world, something like this can really, truly be helpful. I mean, I wish I had this in college. So.
And what website is there associated with this if somebody listening to us wants to find out more?
It's just pymetrics.com. So it's pymetrics.com.
Pymetrics.com.
Yep.
Thank you very much for joining us. This is a fascinating area of research and work. Obviously, you have some fun with this, too, and it's got to be very rewarding.
It is, Bob. It's really, it's pretty great to build something from scratch and have people get so much out of it. Yep.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you, Bob.
Whew. What a busy show this morning. Ay, 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 ay. It's Football Sunday on The Fan. After our 8 o'clock update, Rick Wolf has the Sports Edge program. And long and literally standing in the wings, it's that cast of characters that bring us the NFL preview. Ladies and gentlemen, we present The Voice.
Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up. You get early payout on parlays, too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. and T's apply.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Once upon a mundane morning, Barb's day got busy without warning. A realtor in need of an open house sign? No, 50 of them. And designed before 9.
My head hurts.
Any mighty tools to help with this plight?
Aha!
Barb made her move. She opened Canva and got in the groove.
Bulk creating Canva sheets. Create 50 signs fit for suburban streets.
Done in a click. All complete.
Sweet!
Now, imagine what your dreams can become when you put imagination to work at canva.com.
Whatever happens today, take it on with a fresh cup of True Brew coffee. Now only $1 with True Rewards. True North Store's True Brew Coffee is a hot, flavorful gourmet blend created from coffee beans from around the world. As a free True Rewards member, pick the size that is perfect for you and pay only $1. Don't have the True Rewards mobile app? Find it in the Apple or Google Play Store to download and save instantly. True North Convenience Stores. Fast, friendly, clean.
Did you know your credit card points and miles can lose value to inflation? Credit card companies often reduce the redemption value of your points and miles. Now, imagine a credit card with rewards that can grow in value. With the Gemini credit card, you can earn Bitcoin or one of over 50 other cryptos instantly with no annual fee. Every swipe at the store or gas pump earns you instant rewards deposited straight to your account. Plus, sign up now for a $200 Bitcoin bonus to kickstart your rewards. Visit Gemini.com/card today. Check out the link in the description for more information on rates and fees. Again, if you're looking to invest in Bitcoin but don't know where to start, the Gemini credit card makes it easy.
The Gemini credit card is issued by WebBank. In order to qualify for the $200 crypto intro bonus, you must spend $3,000 in your first 90 days. Terms apply. Some exclusions apply to instant rewards in which rewards are deposited when the transaction posts. This content is not investment advice, and trading crypto involves risk. For more details on rates, fees, and other cost information, see rates and fees. The Gemini credit card may not be used to make gambling-related purchases.